Good evening, K-Squid listeners, and a very happy spring rebirth to you. It's every other Sunday again, and I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, back in the programmer's chair at the studio after a year away from the station. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a biweekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. These days, we're hearing a lot about plans to transform the country's energy infrastructure from one based on fossil fuels to one based on renewable energy resources. President Biden appears to be making this transformation one of his signature initiatives. Certainly, the technology exists, the money is probably there, but there's one elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about: getting the American public to go along. That clip, music clip, that I played at the beginning of the show is called Green Economy, and it's by Lolka Es Boka, which, according to my research, is a Hungarian children's cartoon from the 1970s. But we're going to talk about green economy and greening the economy tonight. And central to the greening of the economy will be the greening of business and companies, large and small. My guest today is Brooke Wright, who manages the Monterey Bay Green Business Program, which is part of the California Green Business Network. The CGBN is a network of local programs funded by grassroots contributions from local government and utility partners to allow small to medium-sized businesses implement specific practices to reduce pollution, save water, conserve energy, and protect human health. Brooke, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome to Sustainability Now. Yes, you're coming in loud and clear.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, let's begin where I always like to start these interviews, with your career trajectory. I know you graduated from UC Santa Cruz with a degree in environmental studies. When did that happen, and why did you major in environmental studies?
Well, my career trajectory started long before that, actually. I graduated there in 2010, but I had gone back to school after years of being in different law firms, doing legal assistant work, and kind of hitting the wall where there wasn't more for me to do without a college degree. So I went back to school. And I ended up choosing environmental studies after starting in community studies because I found I was able to do more of all the things I wanted to do. I wanted to study a bit of biology. I wanted to continue to focus on policy. I wanted to be involved in social justice and even philosophy. And I was able to pull that off with environmental studies. So that was a big reason for me to choose that major.
And how did it go, by the way?
Oh, it was fantastic. I'd say that, you know, I had some really great classes and, you know, interesting experiences. But the real highlight for me was getting to write a thesis and being able to design that and figure out a topic that really kind of brought in all of those different things that I cared about.
You mentioned that. Maybe we can talk about that thesis later, since I think it'll be relevant to our conversation today.
Yeah.
So people are also always interested in hearing what a college degree is good for. So what did you do after graduation? I think you tried journalism for a while. That's what I found out on the internet. And what else? And what are you doing now?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I did. I actually, right when I graduated, I had the opportunity to work with somebody who was hired by the World Bank to do a literature review and also design some field work to look at how the oil and gas industry globally interacts with gender dimensions, like how it affects gender equity in different parts of the world. And it was really fascinating. I found it absolutely mind-blowing. And I felt like there was no vehicle to get that information more widely known. And that's when I was like, man, it would be so great to do journalism, because then you actually get to get these, you know, interesting things out to the world. So I went to Cabrillo College and took photojournalism and regular journalism, and was able to write for the Santa Cruz Sentinel for some time. At the end of the day, the opportunities career-wise were pretty limited, and at least for those that were addicted to staying in Santa Cruz, which I was. So I ended up going back to some of the things that had gotten me interested in going back to school in the first place, which were healthcare and nutrition and biology, and found a couple of positions that were related to the healthcare policy world and then also biotech. Ultimately, through this wandering story, I found through my volunteerism and with that college degree that I was able to bring those together and get a position at Ecology Action. So it totally paid off in a weird, you know, non-linear fashion, but I was able to get this position where I was involved in recruiting and managing and training volunteers and interns in growing the California Green Business Program locally.
Well, you know, I think many people end up doing things they never dreamt about when they started going to college and, you know, choosing their major. You did end up back in the environmental field. Where are you working now?
So now I'm at Environmental Innovations, which is a certified B corporation that also staffs the California Green Business Network. So I'm working with a team of people that I was working with as colleagues at the time that I was at Ecology Action. And then I was able to make a transfer over to their team just about a little bit over a year ago.
Okay. So why don't we talk about the California Green Business Network? What is that and how does it work? What are its missions and goals?
Sure. So the California Green Business Network, there's members from all over the state that are cities and counties that all pay member dues to be part of this network and then be able to use its resources basically to drive and, even go beyond compliance of local environmental mandates or state or federal mandates as well. It was formally created, I guess 2011, it became the formalized green business program of the state, even though there had been some, you know, actions before that and things were happening before that. But basically, it's the 10-year anniversary of it being the statewide California Green Business Network.
How did it get started? You mentioned 2011, and
long before that, different jurisdictions were already starting their own little green business programs. So in 1995, Sonoma started a program, and then some Alameda County, another one started in the late 90s. And basically what was happening is there were people that were working in different environmental department agencies going out and doing compliance checks on businesses and realizing that some businesses that they went to weren't only meeting compliance, but were far exceeding them, were really like going above and beyond what they needed to meet regular environmental mandates. And there was no vehicle for appreciating that. And there was no, you know, the cities and counties didn't have a way to say thank you, you know, or to, you know, encourage that, you know, above and beyond compliance behavior. So they started forming these programs as a way to do that, to say, okay, you have, you know, your low performers that you try to get up to compliance, but what do you do about the high performers? So that's really the root of where it started. And then as more and more different jurisdictions and people were talking to each other and learning from each other, and as they all, you know, started forming their local programs, they started realizing, well, we're kind of recreating the wheel 100 times over. Let's start, you know, leveraging each other's resources and sharing resources. And that's basically what the network does.
So these businesses that were exceeding the requirements, they were doing so voluntarily?
Right. Exactly. They would just be out there, you know, checking like auto repair shops or let's say restaurants and finding, oh, they're doing more than they, you know, would have to try to keep grease out of the stormwater. And they're doing more than they have to do, you know, reduce waste, all of those kinds of things, you know. So they said, we wanted to find a way to celebrate that.
So a lot of these were basically public health requirements, right? I mean, that's, you know, if you're talking about keeping grease out of the water or oil out of the water, it has something to do with public health, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as the whole program goes, it touches on other things too, including like reducing waste.
Sure.
But I think in its beginning days, I think you're right. I think it really was more about like, yeah, the stormwater. So it'd also be about, you know, the health of the waterways.
Biodiversity and such, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, waste management certainly is a public health issue as well. And as are many of these, you know, environmental concerns.
Right.
So how did you get involved in the Green Business Network?
So, well, for me, it was funny. When I mentioned I was doing different, in the past I had worked at law firms, and one of my sort of gigs to get by in Santa Cruz when I graduated was to work at a local law firm. And one of the things, that's when I was there, somebody from the city of Santa Cruz reached out to see if we wanted to join the program. So that's when I first learned of it. So when I saw Ecology Action was hiring for somebody to do this volunteer and intern recruitment for the Green Business Program, I was already pretty familiar with the program and enthusiastic about it.
Okay.
That was my background for that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what do you do then as the regional manager?
So sort of like the statewide network works, where we have a bunch of members across the state and we all get together a couple times a year. And then we provide, at EI, we provide resources and staff time to try to get everybody resources across the state. The regional program, we do the same thing. We have quarterly meetings, and that involves staff from the city and county of Monterey, from the county of San Benito's integrated waste management. It also involves staff from the city of Santa Cruz and the county of Santa Cruz. And so we all... And the city of Watsonville. They just started their own separate program in the last couple of years. So we all get together and, you know, figure out if there's strategies of how we want to grow the program locally. We'll do joint recognition events for our businesses. Just another level of like pulling resources to be able to help the businesses, promote them, things like that. So I'd say the biggest thing we do that's public facing is we have a website, that's the Monterey Bay Green Business Program website, and a Facebook page, and also an Instagram, Shop Green Monterey Bay. So between those three things, we try to just take the opportunity anytime a business gets certified, we do some promotions to get it, you know, acknowledged, sort of in the spirit of that original Green Business Program.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Brooke Wright, who manages the Monterey Bay Green Business Program, which is part of the California Green Business Network. One of the things that the business network does is to certify businesses, and I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about what that involves.
Yeah, definitely. So basically the program is free. What we do is we get a business, once they're registered, we'll do a form of an audit. And, you know, speaking of from your little announcement just now about COVID-19, the whole quarantine and everybody sheltering in place had, of course, given us reason to really change how we do audits, which used to be very field-based. And there was a lot of hand-holding through the whole process of certification. And so what we do now, and I think it's actually really better for the businesses too, is we empower them more to give us the information that we need in order to get them certified. So once they get enrolled, we walk through with them some of the major steps that it takes every business to get certified. For instance, we have to make sure that the lighting is all efficient lighting, that the plumbing, the toilets and the sinks are all low flow and efficient, all of those kinds of things. So we have the business take photos and send us pictures, or we also train them on their own application online. If they want to do their own computer work, then we'll have them do that, and we'll show them through, you know, a video call where we screen share. We'll show them how to update their own application. So basically, we go through everything that relates to sustainability. We talk about transportation, we talk about water conservation, we talk about energy conservation, waste reduction. And as we do that, we're also making sure as a baseline that they're meeting whatever the basic compliance regulations are for that jurisdiction. But then we start finding out, well, what else are you doing around, you know, because a lot of businesses that join are also already doing something that they're proud of. So we try to find out, what are the things you're already doing? And, oh, that ties to some other measures we have in here. And then we try to just move them through in a way that sort of acknowledging the work they're already doing and also opening them up to some new things that they could do to improve the environmental outcomes.
But again, they're doing a lot of this on a voluntary basis, right? I mean, we're assuming that businesses are meeting the basic requirements imposed by state and local law, correct?
Well, no.
No? Why not?
That's actually one of the reasons that agencies and, you know, jurisdictions like this program so much is that they're not necessarily meeting them. And so one of the benefits of us being out there is we get to do that compliance check as part of it. So I've had several businesses that I've worked with that it turned out they just didn't have a waste service because they didn't want to pay for a garbage bill, but they want to get a green business certification, and you have to have a waste service if you're going to do that. So that's part of it too, that we're helping them become compliant as well, and that's the benefit to the city or county.
Curious about this. Does this mean that those businesses were taking garbage home in the evening and putting it
exactly
in their bins? Really?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Mom and pop shops, you know, they're on their shoestring budgets, and a lot of times they're just doing, they're being efficient, but yeah, it's not compliant. So.
Go on.
So I was just going to mention too that it is free for the business to do it, and then you were saying, wait, but they're doing it voluntarily. And I would say one thing that our whole program has really, it always tried to help businesses save money by the fact that, you know, if you switch to LED bulbs, ultimately you're going to save money on your energy bill, and, you know, with several of the areas. But I would say we're even more focused on that than before, that we really want to have that as part of the value proposition of doing the program, partly because even though its roots were in the working with the high performers, that's not where we're at now. Where we're at now is we want every business to be part of this. We want it to be a full movement. And then, you know, therefore, we try to make it so that the whole program keeps that in mind and it's able to be accessible to, you know, businesses that aren't going to have to pay much out of pocket, basically.
Well, I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here. So we can assume that there are businesses who are not meeting the requirements but are not stepping up to improve their performance, right?
You mean like businesses that don't join our program?
No, that businesses that don't, you know, meet the requirements, the state and local requirements. I mean, you have to ask or join in order to get audited, right? But if you don't want to get audited, you don't have to ask or join, right?
Right.
And there's no one who's chasing those other businesses.
Well, they are.
They are. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Local agencies have requirements that they send their outreach folk out to go do compliance checks.
Uh-huh.
So businesses are getting compliance checks all the time. By us going and getting it preemptively, it kind of shoulders some of that burden for the local agencies.
So, I see.
But the business, ultimately they're getting checked for things like that. I don't know in different jurisdictions or different cities, you know, how often, so I don't know how long it would fly under the radar that a business didn't have its own waste. For instance, I think it probably depends on where exactly the program is where exactly the business is.
Uh-huh.
But ultimately the waste management and the waste haulers, they're looking for that because, that's one way that illegal dumping is reduced, to make sure everybody has a service and there's no reason to dump illegally. So.
Yeah. Okay. So I know we talked about this as well. Are there any performance results or data that illustrate the effectiveness of going green and the impact of the business network on environmental conditions in California and Santa Cruz?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have basically with our online system, there's data metrics that are being calculated on the back end of quite a few of the measures, not all of them. But for instance, with the LED lights, if a business switches from T12 fluorescents to LED lights, we'll count how many bulbs they changed out, and then we'll be able to collect all of that energy savings that took place. So when we go report back to the state or even to the business to say, hey, you know, this is the impact you're having, we can spit out a report that shows them exactly how many kilowatt hours they saved. We can also then go to the state and say, oh, the whole, across the whole state, this is what we're saving you through this program. So, yeah, we have that for the water conservation, the energy, the waste. There's hazardous waste being calculated as well. I'm trying to remember what else is on that. Those are the ones that stick out for me right now. Oh, greenhouse gas emissions.
I wonder, it just occurred to me, do you ever run into businesses who end up using more electricity after they do the change than before? There's this phenomenon that I'm sure you studied in environmental, you know, at UCSC, which is that and it had to do with cars, you know, that when cars started getting better mileage and the cost per mile was cheaper, people started driving more, eliminating any savings that result, you know, that were the result of the improved mileage.
Yes, I've seen that. I've seen that in my own household with having LED bulbs suddenly saying, well, we never have to turn the lights out. <You know>? I know what you mean. And I think that I haven't seen that at the businesses. And I think that part of that is probably because, again, like with the program, we have occupancy sensors as one of the measures.
Yeah,
things
okay,
like that,
sure.
So we should be, yeah, working. The one place I've seen it is with waste, partly because of what I just shared with you, that we sometimes you get there, there's no on-site collection happening. And so suddenly we're saying, no, we have to have a waste service. So in terms of our back-end data, that doesn't look as good on our data side, because now we're collecting garbage.
Yeah, so the garbage starts to become visible, yeah,
yeah,
and shows
yeah,
up.
But real world impact, there's no difference really. So, possibly it's good.
You mentioned that businesses can join for free, right?
Right. Yeah. Almost, and certainly in this area, there's maybe one program in Southern California where they charge a membership fee, but not here.
So how is the California Green Business Network funded? Who pays for it?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways. One is that the cities and counties pay membership dues, and those are based on how big a city is. They'll pay a different membership due. And then, so that, I think, accounts for, I won't even make up a number. I'm not sure exactly how much is the overall budget. But that that traditionally was how the network worked. For the first, I don't know, 6 or 7 years of it being the state program, that's how it worked. And then we were able to get, I think there was some grants that were achieved during that time as well that helped pay for some of it. But in the last 3 years, we've been able to get a $1 million grant from the state of California. And that helps pay for a lot of the things that the network is doing. And also some of that goes back to the cities and counties in the form of a sort of micro grant for them to be able to bolster and grow their programs. So there's money going both ways now.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the next step would be to try and calculate how much money businesses are saving and try and capture some of those savings. That's
well,
how...
Yeah, that's actually part of that same report that I described. It also captures the cost savings.
Uh-huh.
So if it says, you know, reduced by this many kilowatt hours, then it would also say how much, you know, is off the energy bill from that.
Oh, no, that's not exactly what I meant. What I meant was that if a business finds that its electric bill goes down, right, let's just say it goes down $50, right, mm-hmm. then they should give you $25 of those savings to help support the program. Right. There are companies there are companies that actually do that with electricity and probably with other things, right? They help people save money, and part of the payback is that some of that savings has to actually be paid out in cash.
Right.
That's a sort of devious. I'm not saying you should go out and do that, but that would be the next step.
I mean, I think the spirit of this program is really that, you know, look, like a large business has the staff and the resources to figure out the best practices around sustainability and to be a shining star, you know, to get a lot of accolades and all of that for being a sustainability hero. And the tiny mom and pop shop, there's just no way. They just can't, you know, they're just scraping by. And so the spirit of it is that at the very least, we can do this work for you. We can try to line you up with the resources, and you'll be the one to enjoy the benefits of it, you know? So I don't see us taking a commission on it anytime soon, but who knows, you know, it depends what happens with budgets.
I'm just throwing that one out because I know that that's often part of the...
Go ahead.
I wanted to
really like point out this pivot that's happening with the program right now. That I mentioned how it started out as really like wanting to recognize the high performers, and over the years also wanting to be a sort of a movement. There be enough that like ever you know you can create different coordinators across the state have found. Oh, if you tell a restaurant, you know, your neighbor, your competitor down the road is doing this, then they're going to do it too. So like wanting to create some of that momentum has been, you know, a big part of how the program has worked. But more recently, especially in the last year, there's a really big motivation on the part of the board of directors and even those of us that are staffing a lot of the work at CAGDEN to be a lot more equitable in how we're approaching businesses, in the businesses that are getting into the program and able to succeed in it. And so we're doing a lot more to try to make it accessible program for everybody and not be that only high performers can be recognized through this. So one of the things we did is created a sort of like lower level tier, like an entry level tier, mm-hmm. where businesses can get through these most important things, which actually have an ROI. That's just like, you're going to start saving money on your utilities if you do these. And through up until last month, we also then, any business that did that, we were able to reimburse them up to $500 for anything they had to pay to do it. Or anything they would have to pay, if they didn't have to pay anything just to do that piece, then it could go towards what they might have to pay.
I see.
To go through the rest of it.
Is that coming out of the grant?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Yeah. So there are those incentives. Okay.
Yeah. Now, they did get all spent out, so we don't have any of them right now, and we're just sort of like crossing our fingers waiting for the state to say, yes, we want to fund this again, and we want to, you know, increase that program.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, and my guest today is Brooke Wright, who is manager of the Monterey Bay Green Business Program. We've been talking about what businesses are expected to do, how they're audited, various kinds of incentives to make them help get them greener, and how the program has been funded. Well, Brooke, let's turn to something more, philosophical and political.
Wonderful.
And we mentioned this already, right, that the CGBN depends on individual business owners and operators to commit to certain standards and practices and to meet them. But the decision is up to the individual business owner. If you take the case of containers and stuff you get along with takeout food, restaurants decide whether or not to make sure that stuff is really recyclable and compostable. But that's only required up to a point. So why wouldn't a government requirement or regulation make more sense?
Well, I think it's not a an either or situation. And what I've been observing, and I'm glad you brought up that example with like foodware, basically, is I'm seeing with some of the programs we're working in that we're working in cahoots with that effort to create ordinances. So for instance, I'm just thinking of one we worked on in the fall is San Juan Bautista in San Benito County. They created a foodware ordinance, and it was supposed to go into effect last year, and like a lot of places that, across the state and maybe beyond, they postponed. I think City of Santa Cruz had one that was also supposed to infect. What was it? The cup fee. And they ended up postponing that because of the pandemic.
Were those reusable cups or something else?
They were, you would have to pay a fee or a cup.
Right.
Yeah, if you don't bring your own.
If you don't bring your own, right.
Yeah. And that was supposed to go into effect a long time ago, and I think it actually just went into effect last month. So now, if you go into a city of Santa Cruz cafe or something, I think they have to charge you a cup fee.
So it's back. So does that mean that, coffee shops are letting people bring in their reusable cups again?
Yeah, it's just tricky because then you also have the online ordering. Right?
So yeah.
You have to sort of navigate those two. But yeah. I successfully did it with the Cafe Del Marette, a certified green business. I was able to go down there after ordering online, and I just put it in the notes, I'm bringing my own cup. And I didn't have to pay the cup fee. So.
Yeah, but it's not right there. It's not waiting for you to grab. Well, you know, honest with you, I see people come in sometimes to coffee shop, you know, and grab their coffee off the shelf. And I'm a troglodyte, first of all. And second of all, I can't imagine, you know, what's so important that you can't spend a couple of minutes waiting in line, right? It's
high-speed world, yeah.
It's a high-speed world. But you can't drink your coffee any more quickly, right? That doesn't get speeded up. You mentioned that foodware ordinance. I'm just curious, are there any other aspects to that besides the...
Well, yeah, I was going to describe. So with San Juan Bautista, what we did is, so the city had already decided to do this foodware ordinance, you know, where they were going to require that that businesses can't give single-use dishware if somebody's going to be eating on site, and if it's to go, then it has to be BPI certified compostable. So, you know, they were making this ordinance, and the way that they did the outreach to the businesses was they joined up with our green business staff and said, let's go to the businesses and let them know this is the rule. It's coming down the pipe in a few months. We know it's going to cost money to buy that BPI compostable foodware, to-go-ware, but here's one way you could offset it. Because like I've mentioned, we have those rebates.
Right,
so
yeah.
You'd say to the business, we know you have this one thing. We'd like to also give you the carrot of the Green Business Program where you can offset the cost difference. And so that's one way that they can work together is if a jurisdiction's already putting an ordinance in. But the other way that I think it's worked a lot of times in the past, and this would cover, well beyond foodware, like maybe, you know, stormwater prevention, you know, with the grease traps or things like that.
Yeah.
Would be, you know, you get enough businesses to do it voluntarily through the Green Business Program, for instance. And then you can go to city council, you can go and advocate, you know, from your, you know, to the environmental committee or, you know, to city council and say, look, it works. These businesses are already doing it. They're doing fine. And, you know, maybe have them come bring a testimonial. And then you can go from that to an ordinance. So it's not, I think it's not the final destination with a voluntary program, but it can create pilots and you can start to ferret out what are the problems that happen when you have a certain ordinance and how do you make that easier for everybody if you actually make it a mandate. So I think that's the relationship between it. And I never forget, I think it was Daniel Press, I took a class from at UCSC on environmental policy, and it was a really strong argument about the you know, lack of efficacy of voluntary incentive programs. And I was really moved by it. And so I kind of went into this with a lot of, I don't know, but I then have learned about how it actually has created these pilots and these ways of like creating the story so that you can say, look, you know, we can actually, you know, show case studies of it working and these businesses are doing just fine. So let's get everybody to do it now.
You had mentioned to me when we were talking that you did your senior thesis on something related to this, right? Can you describe that?
I think the relationship was that we were talking a little bit about capitalism.
Well, I want to get to that, but I wasn't. I was trying, you know, not to get to it too soon.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the relationship for the most part. Because what I got to write my thesis on, which again was just such a delight to be able to do, but it was about prisons and what leads to, and this was, you know, this was in 2010. So even in 2010, there was a lack of awareness. You know, now, I mean, everybody across the political spectrum understands that the prisons went nuts, that there was just way too much, too many people put behind bars. But so when I wrote it, that was a little bit less well known. But Not that the problem has gone away, but
right,
more people are aware of it.
Yeah.
But I was looking at what it is, the whole view of prisons as being either a place for punishment or a place for rehabilitation. And I ended up writing an argument that that's a false dichotomy, that the people that are in there, a lot of them are neither in need of rehabilitation, which is built on a medical model, nor of punishment. They're usually in need of good opportunities that they were never afforded because, you know, things aren't very fair. So that was the thesis talks about that view that led to those two, that dichotomy. And it was really coming from these sort of neoliberal, capitalist kind of views on how society works. Somebody either needs to be, you know, patronized and condescended to or punished. And that was,
Well, I mean, if you want to really get into it, there's a sense in which the morality, the whole morality of our, I guess, of our economic system is based on those notions, right? Costs and benefits, that if you do things in a certain way, you'll suffer from costs and that will inflict pain. So is the utilitarian view, right? And if you do it the other way, you'll get benefits and you'll feel much better. And that's really what we're looking for, right? And I mean, there's a sense in which that kind of argument is applied everywhere, and then, of course, laid on individuals and individual businesses, which gets us back to this question about voluntary compliance, right? Mm-hmm. The businesses that do comply get rewarded, or at least they get a certificate of superior performance, and that, we presume, benefits them because customers are looking for businesses that are, you know, greener. And if they don't, right, they'll suffer costs because customers will avoid them. And, you know, that's a question which is still out there, and I'm not quite sure whether it's been answered or not. And I know I'm lecturing here as a college professor, but I'm not sure that's just neoliberalism. I think that's deeply embedded in the in Western society, you know, and it's the way that religion has influenced how we look at the world. But that's a whole different, ball of wax or kettle of fish or whatever the story is. Why don't we take a break and then we'll come back and we will talk about capitalism, because this is related to what we were just talking about, but there is this much larger question about whether it's possible to actually make the economy as green as necessary.
Right.
So you're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD. My guest today is Brooke Wright, who is the manager of the Monterey Bay Green Business Program, and which is part of the California Green Business Network. CGBN is a network of local programs that allow small to medium-sized businesses to implement specific practices to reduce pollution, save water, conserve energy, and protect human health. And as I mentioned at the outset of the program, we're hearing a lot about the green economy, the Green New Deal, President Biden's infrastructure program, which is including a whole lot of money for renewable energy and various other kinds of conservation strategies. And one of the questions that has been raised, which is, again, I guess it's another elephant in the room, and that is, can capitalism actually be made green? Well, there's a long backstory to this. But what's your view on this, Brooke?
The first thing that comes to my mind when I think of a question like that is something that speech I saw, or maybe it was reading a book that Obama said, which was better is good. And I think he was talking about some conversation he had with his own team, and, you know, they were struggling with things not going the way they wanted or something, or not quickly enough in the direction they wanted. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think that we're in a capitalist market, and so this is the tool that we have. So I think, yes, things could be made better within the current framework that we have.
Well, of course, that's government regulation is intended in part to tame the excesses of our economy. That's what utility regulation was originally intended to do, right? Was to give utilities monopoly privileges within specified territories, and then restrict how much money they could make, so they couldn't gouge consumers. I mean, some people might think PG&E is gouging, and PG&E is gouging them now. But so regulation is an old tradition, right? It goes back to these requirements that we were talking about earlier. And yet there is this view as well that regulation is a bad thing, that voluntary compliance is much better.
Mm. Yeah, and I'd say, yeah, my personal view, and yeah, definitely this is me speaking personally, but is that you absolutely could not get away with just voluntary. That strikes me as a very conservative view and one that's very helpful to big business, not necessarily the small business, but I think that, yeah, because there's nothing that without those sort of artificial frameworks put in place, there's nothing that actually incentivizes a purchase that does low carbon emissions over one that does high carbon emissions. Like that doesn't exist in a pure capitalist sense. That only exists once you add layers of these value systems to it that we're adding.
Well, let's come back to that, because that, of course, raises issues of long-term costs and benefits. I hope you don't feel like I'm trying to back you into a corner with this. But
I love it.
I don't know that it's come up in previous shows, and it seems to me that it is an important question. Well, I sent you some questions, and I invoked James O'Connor, who was a professor in environmental studies until he retired in 1992. Of course, that was long before you were there. But he wrote something about something he called the second contradiction of capitalism. And for those of you who are knowledgeable about such stuff, the first contradiction, which was formulated by our friend Karl Marx, or my friend Karl Marx anyway, pointed out in essence that if labor is not paid a wage which allows workers to buy the stuff they produce, overproduction of goods will take place because there will be nobody who can afford to buy that stuff, and an economic crisis will ensue. And we actually saw that, I think, at the beginning of, we saw that in the Great Recession, and we saw that to some degree at the beginning of the pandemic, when, you know, business ground to a halt and people weren't buying things, and there was, at least in some areas, there was excess stuff sitting around not getting sold. O'Connor's contradiction is a little bit different. And it states that capitalism does not pay for the pollution and waste it produces, or rather that resources are considered to be free, offered by nature, and businesses and corporations don't pay for that. You know, the argument is a little bit more complicated, but ultimately it undermines the material foundation on which capitalism is based. And it's another way of saying that greenhouse gas emissions could destroy the viability of human civilization on Earth if they're not controlled and regulated. Now, I mean, there's a kind of a, again, I'm lecturing to you, Brooke. I hope that's okay, and to our listeners. But, I mean, there is this sort of irony here, right, which is that O'Connor is, in some sense, arguing that if stuff isn't properly priced, people will waste it. And I don't know if Jim actually thought about that, but this gets back to the question of putting a price on pollution, right? And environmental damage of some sort, sorts. And it gets back to the issue of, do underperforming businesses get penalized for not performing?
Right, and then that can bring in an equity issue too, because if it, you know, it's hard to perform, you know, like that could end up squeezing out a lot of business owners if you make it too hard to be able to meet compliance because it's so expensive to meet compliance, you know, in the same way that like building an ADU costs like $300,000 to be able to meet all the compliance regulations.
Well, I'm hoping to find a way to make them cheaper, but okay, go on.
I don't know if I have anything to go on from there, but
well, there's this other argument which follows, you know, and in a sense tries to undermine that, which is that if we can avoid that second contradiction by using resources more efficiently, reducing waste and recycling, and of course greening the economy, right? That we can do more with less, you know, that stuff can last longer and be more durable. And in some ways, that's the point of the Green New Deal, right? Is that by developing a green economy, you're going to generate so much in the way of benefits that the costs will be covered. And, of course, efficiency, the shift to renewables and efficiency will more than make up for the losses that are suffered because of the conversion. When you go and you talk to business owners, I'm sure you don't talk about the second contradiction of capitalism. You know, how do you... What do you tell them?
I think, of, especially with the small mom and pop shops, and especially in the last year, I really think of the ROI and try to really stay focused on the things that are very tangible benefits for them.
Can you define
the fact that we can do what's that?
Define ROI. You use that big just in case.
Well, I mean, pretty like capitalist outcomes of what they can do, of what they'll do, the benefits of doing it. So the, you know, we'll do marketing and promotions for the business, and hopefully that will bring them more customers. We'll help them lower their utility bills. We'll get them the $500, you know, just very like financial-based incentives. And part of the reason for that is that I think it, you know, being able to do something voluntarily, it requires that you already, you know, it's like Maslow's hierarchy. Like it requires you already have the basics met. Even just having bandwidth for another project is sometimes, you know, a lot to ask of a small business owner. So I really focus on that. I think that's the way that we make the program expansive to be able to include a lot of businesses that otherwise just don't have the bandwidth or don't have the resources. So, you know, certainly I meet business owners who are, you know, deeply concerned about climate change and you know, local environmental pollution and all those kinds of things. And, you know, with it, depending on who I'm talking to, and I think that's true for everybody in this program, you kind of have to know your audience, but there can be other, you know, aspects of it that we can bring to light. And what you were just talking about, I'll just point out one thing that made me think about is that, you know, when you were talking about the Green New Deal and its focus, one of the things with the Green Business Program that's been one reason that there's been a lot of motivation to try to get this kind of behavior really normalized is that, you know, we all hear about the recycling markets all the time, about how,
yeah,
you know, they can't find buyers for the junk, this plastic that was supposed to be recyclable, but there, it turns out nobody can make it into something useful or valuable for less, you know, than it's worth. So the one goal is, you know, just like what happened with electric vehicles getting a lot of federal grants and things like that to like spur that economy. One goal is that if we get more businesses buying recycled content materials, so buying, you know, like to be a green business, you have to buy recycled content paper products and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But it'll make the value proposition of converting recyclable or recycled materials into something useful again go up, and, you know, be able to make that market really happen in ways that a lot of it doesn't right now, so, or hasn't in the past. So,
well, yeah, one of the challenges, of course, is making the virgin materials more expensive than the recycled ones, right? I mean, if you take
right.
the case of plastics, oil, relatively speaking, is quite cheap, and as oil, assuming oil consumption declines in the future, right, as we shift to renewables, that will make it even cheaper. And I understand oil companies are getting into the plastics market so that they have something to do with their product.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like the leaky balloon problem, and I don't know that anybody has quite figured out, you know, what to do about that.
No, it should be more expensive to produce something that has, you know, 100-year or multi-100-year negative impact on the world. That should
yeah.
be really expensive. That should be like, oh yeah, we use that for surgery because it's that important.
Right.
But
right.
not for your latte cup lid. You know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Brooke, listen. We're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thanks for having me, Ronnie. I really appreciate it.
So I want to thank you for listening tonight. Thanks again to Brooke Wright, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station. And until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.